74. Monday dawn. Reveille in the Sharashka was at 7 a.m. But on Monday morning a guard entered the room where the labourers lived long before Reveille, and shook the yardman by his shoulder. Spiridon gave one loud snore, recovered consciousness, and looked at the guard in the dim light from the blue bulb.
"Get dressed, Yegorov. The lieutenant wants you,"
the guard said quietly.
Yegorov lay there open-eyed, but did not stir.
"Didn't you hear? I said the lieutenant wants you."
"What's up? Have you gone crazy or something?"
Spiridon asked, still without moving. The guard shook him.
"Get up now. Get up. Don't ask me what it's about."
"Lord, oh Lord."
Spiridon stretched, put his gingerhead hands behind his head and yawned lengthily.
"Bring on the day when I don't have to get up any more. What time is it?"
"Soon be six."
"Not six yet?"
"All right, you go. Needn't wait."
He went on lying there. The guard hesitated, then left. The blue lamp lit a corner of Spiridon's pillow as far as the oblique shadow of the upper bunk. Partly in the light, partly in shade, Spiridon lay with his hands behind his head, motionless. He was regretting that he had not seen the end of his dream. He had been riding on a cart loaded with dry brushwood, and under it some logs he had concealed from the forester. He seemed to be riding from the forest back home to his house in the village, but by an unfamiliar road. Though he didn't recognize the road, he saw clearly, with both eyes, they were both good in his dream, where bulging roots were breaking the surface, where lightning had splintered a tree, where there were small pine needles or sand in which wheels might sink and get stuck. Spiridon could also smell in his dream the varied scents of early autumn, and he breathed them in greedily. Even in his sleep he was acutely aware that he was a Zek, that he was serving a sentence of 10 years with a 5-year collar, that he seemed to have absented himself from the Sharashka, that they must have missed him by now, but hadn't yet sent the dogs after him, so he must hurry up and get the firewood to his wife and daughter. But what most of all made it a happy dream was his horse. Not any old horse, but the best that Spiridon had ever owned, his roan mare Grivna, bought as a 3-year-old to work the little farm he had after the Civil War. Her coat would have been all grey but for the bay underhair. Grey and bay merged in a colour that could best be called pink. With this horse he had begun to prosper, and he had put her between the shafts when he eloped with Marfa Ustinovna. As he rode along now, Spiridon was surprised and delighted to find Grivna still alive and as young as ever, hauling her load uphill with never a stumble, and struggling spiritedly through the sandy patches. Grivna's thoughts always showed in her sensitively pricked-up ears. She never looked back. A twitch of her ears told her master that she knew what was wanted of her and could cope. Even a distant glimpse of a whip would have been an insult to Grivna. Spiridon left the whip behind when he was out with her. In his dream he felt like getting down from the cart and kissing Grivna on her muzzle, so overjoyed was he that she was still young and would obviously still be alive and waiting when his sentence ended. But as they went down the slope toward the stream, he realized that his cart was tilting to one side, that branches were slipping off, and that the whole load threatened to collapse at the ford. A sudden jolt flung Spiridon to the ground, and it turned out to be the guard shaking him. He lay in bed, remembering not only Grivna, but dozens of horses he had driven and worked with in his life. Every one of them was etched on his memory like a living person, as well as thousands he had seen elsewhere, and it galled him to think how wantonly, against all reason, those best of helpers had been exterminated, some starved to death for want of hay and oats, some flogged to death while they worked, some sold to Tartars as meat. Anything at all reasonable, Spiridon could understand. But he could not understand why they had done away with horses. They had tried to kid everybody that the tractor would do the horses' work. Instead, the whole burden had fallen on the women. It wasn't just the horses, though. Hadn't Spiridon himself chopped down fruit trees on peasant farms so that people there would have nothing to lose? That way they'd give in more easily and join the collective.
"Yegorov!
This time the guard yelled at him from the doorway, waking two other prisoners.
"I'm coming, blast you!"
Spiridon yelled back, lowering his feet to the ground. He wandered over to the radiator to retrieve his dry socks.
"Where are you off to, Spiridon?"
his neighbour, the blacksmith, asked.
"Our masters are calling me, to earn my rations,"
the yardman said angrily. Spiridon was no slug abed at home, but in prison he didn't like having to get himself together in the dark. To be forced out of bed before it's light is about the worst thing that can happen to a prisoner. But in the North Urals camp they got you up at 5, so it was best to grin and bear it in the Sharashka. Spiridon adjusted his long army foot rags to cover the space between his wadded trousers and army boots. Dressed and shod, he slipped into loose blue overalls, shrugged on his black overcoat, donned his fur hat, buckled a frayed canvas belt around his waist, and set off. He was let out through the steel door of the prison, and walked on unescorted. The steel tips on his shoes grated on the concrete floor of the underground hallway. He climbed the narrow steps into the yard. Spiridon could see nothing in the snowy gloom, but his feet told him beyond all doubt that something like 18 inches of snow had fallen. So it must have been snowing heavily all night. Kicking the snow as he went, Spiridon made for the light over the staffroom door. At that moment the duty officer, the lieutenant with the miserable little moustache, appeared on the threshold of the administrative building. He had left the medical assistant a little while ago to find the world untidy. Snow had fallen. So he had sent for the yardman. The lieutenant tucked both hands into his belt and said,
"All right, Yegorov, get on with it. Clear a path from the main entrance to the guardhouse and from here to the kitchen, and another over there across the exercise yard. Get on with it. If everybody has a bit, there'll be nothing left for the husband,"
Spiridon muttered as he set off across the virgin snow with his shovel.
"What's that you said?"
the lieutenant asked angrily. Spiridon looked around.
"I said, Yavol, boss, Yavol,"
which is what he used to say when the Germans gave him orders.
"Tell them in the kitchen to slip me a few potatoes." "All right, get sweeping."
Spiridon always behaved sensibly and avoided clashes with his bosses, but on this occasion he felt particularly sore, because it was Monday morning, because he was forced to slave away again before his eyes were really open, because there was a letter from home waiting for him, and he had a premonition that it brought bad news. He felt a burning pain in his chest as the miseries of 50 years on this earth crowded in on him. The snow had stopped falling. The limes were breathlessly still, white not with yesterday's frost, which had vanished by supper-time, but with snow that had fallen overnight. Spiridon judged by the darkness of the sky and the stillness of the air that the snow would not hold. He started sullenly, but once he had warmed up, after the first 100 shovelfuls, the work went steadily and even enjoyably. Spiridon was like that, and so was his wife. However heavy the troubles that weighed on them, Spiridon and Marfa sought relief in work, and found it. Disobeying orders, Spiridon did not begin by clearing a path from the guardroom for the bosses. He used his own judgment and started with the path to the kitchen, then made a circular track, 3 broad wooden shovelfuls wide, around the exercise yard for his fellow zecs. But his mind was on his daughter. His wife and he himself had lived their lives. His sons were behind barbed wire, but they were men. Young men should get tough for when life becomes rough. But his daughter. Although he had no sight in one eye and 3/10 vision in the other, Spiridon had made an absolutely regular oval track around the exercise yard by 7 a.m. when the first enthusiasts, Potapov and Khorobrov, had climbed the steps from the basement, having risen and washed before Revali, to take their morning exercise. Fresh air was rationed and precious.
"What's all this, Spiridon?"
Khorobrov asked, turning up the collar of the threadbare civilian overcoat in which he had been arrested all those years ago.
"Didn't you get to bed last night?" "Do you think those reptiles let a man sleep?"
Spiridon replied. But he no longer felt so angry. That hour of silent work had dispelled his dark thoughts about his jailers. Without putting it into words, Spirita knew in his heart that if his daughter was in trouble through some fault of her own, that made things no easier for her, and he must respond with kindness, not curse her. Even this weighty thought about his daughter, which had come down to him from the lime trees waiting rigidly for the dawn, was gradually pushed to the back of his mind by the trivial concerns of the day. The two planks buried somewhere under a snowdrift, the need to mount his brush on a sturdier broomstick. First, though, he had to clear a path from the guardroom for cars and for the free workers. Spiridon shouldered his shovel and disappeared around the corner of the Sharashka. Sologdin, lithe and trim, with a padded jacket draped loosely round his shoulders, which never felt the cold, went by toward the woodpile. When he walked along like this, he often heard in his imagination a voice saying, "There goes Count Sologdin." After yesterday's ludicrous wrangle with Rubin and Rubin's exasperating accusations, he had slept badly for the first time in the 2 years he had been in the Sharashka, and now he needed air and solitude and space to think it all over. He had sawed wood ready. All he had to do was chop it. Potapov was strolling around slowly with Khorobrov, lifting his wounded leg stiffly. He was wearing the ordinary soldier's overcoat he had worn as a member of a tank crew in the assault on Berlin. He had been an officer before he was taken prisoner. Ex-POWs did not retain officer rank. Khorobrov barely had time to shake off his drowsiness and wash, but his mind was already alert for opportunities to vent the hatred that never slept in him. The words bursting from his lips seemed to trace a futile loop in the dark air and return like a boomerang to wound the speaker. "Not so long ago, we used to read that the Ford conveyor belt turns the worker into a machine and is the most inhuman form of capitalist exploitation. But 15 years later, the conveyor belt, under the novel name of the continuous production line, is extolled as the best and most modern mode of production. Chiang Kai-shek was our ally in 1945, but his enemies succeeded in overthrowing him in 1949, and now he is a reptile, and his followers the Chiang Kai-shek clique. Now they're out to topple Nehru, and his regime is described as the rule of the big stick. If they succeed in bringing him down, we will read about the Nehru clique fleeing to the island of Ceylon. If they don't succeed, it will be our noble friend Nehru. The Bolsheviks are such shameless opportunists that if it suddenly proved necessary to convert all Russia to Christianity again, they would unearth the appropriate passage from Marx to show that it was compatible with atheism and internationalism." Potapov was always melancholy in the mornings. That was when he had time to think about his ruined life, about a son growing up without a father, and a wife pining for her absent husband. Later on, his work would take his mind off everything else. Potapov thought that Khorobrov was probably right, but that he was too peevish and too ready to let the West sit in judgment of the Soviet Union. Potapov himself believed that the Soviet people and the Soviet regime must somehow, just how he did not know, settle their family quarrel themselves. So, awkwardly dragging along his damaged leg, he walked on in silence, breathing as deeply and evenly as he could. Shattered by his meeting with his wife the day before, Gerasimovich had stayed in bed all day on Sunday as if sick. Her cry, as she left him, had shaken him badly. He could no longer just wait quietly for his sentence to run its course. Those last 3 years would be too much for Natasha. He had to do something about it. "You could do something right now if you wanted to," she had said reproachfully, knowing how clever he was. Yes, there was something he could use, but it was too precious to put into those hands in return for crumbs from their table. If only he could come up with something, something trivial, but enough to earn him remission. But things don't happen like that. Neither science nor life gives us anything gratis. He felt no better the next morning. It had cost him an effort to come out for exercise. He was well wrapped up, but chilled to the bone, and he wanted to go back inside immediately. But he had run into Kondrashov Ivanov, walked once around the circuit with him, and was his captive for the rest of the exercise period.
"What? You mean to say you don't know about Pavel Dmitrievich Korin?"
Kondrashov sounded surprised, as if this was something every schoolboy knew.
Well, well, well. They say he's got this remarkable picture, only nobody's seen it. Vanishing Russia, it's called. Some say it's 6 meters, some 12. He's kept on a tight rein, his work is never exhibited. He's painted this picture in secret, and when he dies, they'll probably impound it.
Why? What does it show?
I only know what I've been told. I can't vouch for it. It's said to show an ordinary road in central Russia, in a hilly place, with clumps of trees. People are streaming along the road, looking preoccupied. Each individual is painted in painstaking detail. The sort of faces we find in old family photographs, but don't see around us any more. Radiant old Russian faces, peasants, ploughmen, craftsmen, with high foreheads and full beards, people whose complexions, eyes, and thoughts were still clear and youthful in their 70s. The faces of girls whose ears are protected from foul language by invisible golden pendants, girls you couldn't imagine in the Gadarene mob around the dance floor, dignified old women, silver-haired priests walking along in their vestments, monks, Duma deputies, overripe students in double-breasted jackets, schoolboys in quest of universal truths, haughty beauties in early 20th-century town clothes, somebody greatly resembling Karolenka, then more peasants, and more, and more. The most terrible thing is that these people are not in separate groups. Chronological order no longer exists. They are not talking to one another. They don't look at one another. Perhaps they can't even see one another. They carry no traveller's bundles on their backs. They simply go on and on. And they're not just walking along that particular highway. They are walking away altogether. Departing. We are seeing the last of them.
Gerasimovich halted abruptly.
I'm sorry, I must be alone for a while.
He turned sharply on his heel, left the artist in mid-gesture, and walked off in the opposite direction. He felt feverish. Not only could he see the picture as vividly as if he had painted it himself, he couldn't help thinking that. Morning had set in. A guard went around the yard shouting that the exercise period was over. As they went in through the underground hallway, the other prisoners found themselves jostling a morose Rubin, his grim beard emphasizing the sickly pallor of his face. He was trying to push through in the opposite direction. He had overslept and was too late not only for wood chopping, that was unthinkable anyway after his quarrel with Sologdin, but for his morning walkabout. After his brief artificial sleep, Rubin's body was limp and numb. He felt that hunger for oxygen that is unknown to those who can breathe freely whenever they want. He was trying to fight his way out to the yard for a single gulp of fresh air and a handful of snow to rub himself with. But the guard standing at the head of the steps would not let him pass. Rubin stood in the concrete pit down below. A little snow had found its way down there, and there was a refreshing draught. He performed 3 slow circular movements with his arms, taking deep breaths, then collected some snow from the floor of the pit, rubbed his face with it, and wandered back into the prison. Spiridon, now wide awake, and very hungry after clearing a path for cars all the way to the guardhouse, went the same way. In the prison HQ, the 2 lieutenants, the one with the 2 little squares of moustache who was going off duty, and the new arrival, Lieutenant Zhvakun, opened a large envelope and studied the orders left for them by Major Mushin. Lieutenant Zhvakun, a dense, fat-faced ruffian, had risen to the rank of Sergeant Major during the war, serving as a divisional executioner, or, in the official terminology, executive officer attached to the military tribunal, and he had earned further promotion as a result. He greatly valued his position in Special Prison Number 1, and, since literacy was not his strong suit, he perused Mushin's instructions twice to be sure of getting them right. At 8:50, the 2 of them went around the prisoners' rooms to inspect and to announce, as instructed,
"All prisoners are to submit to Major Mushin in the course of the next 3 days a list of their immediate relatives set out as follows. Number of relatives in list, name of relative, surname, given name, patronymic, degree of affinity, place of work, home address. Immediate relatives means mother, father, legal wife, sons and daughters of a legal registered marriage. Other relatives, brothers, sisters, aunts, nieces, grandchildren and grandmothers do not count as immediate relatives. As of January 1st, prisoners will be allowed to correspond with or receive visits from immediate relatives as defined in this list, and no one else. Furthermore, as of January 1st, the size of a prisoner's monthly letter must not exceed one double page of an exercise notebook. This order, so mean and inexorable, defied understanding. No exclamations of despair or indignation sped Zhvakun on his way, only sarcastic cries of "Happy New Year!" and "Cuckoo!" "Denounce our relatives? You mean the sleuths can't find them? Why doesn't it say whether we should write in small letters or capitals?" Zhvakun, counting heads, tried simultaneously to memorize who had shouted, so that he could report them to the major. Treat them well or treat them badly. Prisoners are never satisfied.